Hello, welcome to another episode of Steeped in History. And I am sounding a little bit rough today because I am getting over a bit of a viral infection, so you'll have to forgive my slightly gravelly tones in what will probably be a slightly shorter episode so that I don't tire my poor old voice out too soon. But this week, I would like to move things a little bit further back because I have been talking about the 17th, 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries so far on the podcast. But today, we're going to move things a little further back. But first, the essentials. Today, I am drinking, as you might imagine, a homemade honey, lemon, and ginger infusion because I've got a sore throat and I feel a bit poorly. And I really enjoy making myself a little bit of an infusion. I find that it is a very comforting thing to do. The process, I think, tricks my body into believing that medicine is happening, and so I think I get a little bit of a placebo effect just from making the honey, lemon, and ginger. The process of peeling the ginger, grating the ginger, boiling the water, spooning the honey in, squidging up the lemon and putting it in. And I tend to just stick a slice of lemon in the cup because then you can pour the hot water over the lemon for a second cup of it. And I like mine quite gingery. I think ginger is the bit that makes me feel like, whoa, yeah, this is gonna start kicking this cold's teeth in, or whatever it may be, up to and including severe upper respiratory infections. I have had a lemon and ginger infusion and gone, yeah, this will do it. So I am drinking some honey. I've got about a tablespoon of honey. I've got some ginger. I don't know how much ginger is in here. Finely grated about 2 or 3 mil off the end of a knob of ginger. And then I've got a wadge of lemon. What size is this wadge? Give me a second. Do some wadge measurement. I'd say that I've cut probably about a quarter of an inch of lemon, which I've then squidged into the bottom of the cup and poured the hot water over. So that is what I am drinking today. That is my tea du jour. Not that it's tea. I've always called it lemon and ginger tea or chamomile tea, but it's not tea. Tea is a specific thing. Tea is a plant, right? Some people call these things tea, and like, oh, it's a lemon tea, it's a mint tea. But mint tea isn't a thing. Tea is Camellia sinensis. You know, the tea plant is a specific plant. So I've started trying to call this an infusion or a tisane so that I don't upset people. I like the word tisane. I believe that's what these are called in French. You might know. Please feel free. Feel free if you've got another term that you use for tea that isn't tea. Do let me know on one of the various platforms where this will be going out, because this will be going out on YouTube, attached to my YouTube channel, The Welsh Viking. It's also going to be going out on Spotify and Apple Music and various other podcatchers, and it's also on Audio Boom. It's all over the place. I hadn't quite realised how many places you could listen to this podcast, but it's all over the shop. It's really quite exciting. There's no excuse for you not to be able to listen to it, really. And the second essential topic is, of course, the book. Now, this week, and for several weeks now, I have been reading a spectacular volume. And it's a very chunky book. I'm holding it in my hands right now. And not including its... There's a spider on it. Go away. No shade, but we don't need you right now. Not including its appendices, it is 400 and... No, I beg your pardon. Yes, it is. It is 495 pages long. And this 495 page monster, a full inch and a half thick, is The Holy Blood and the Holy Grail. I know what you're thinking, and you are exactly right. It was first published in 1982, and it was written by Michael Bagent, Richard Lee, and Henry Lincoln, and it is an incredible piece of work. And I'm going to read you the back of the book, and I want you to see if you can figure out what it's about. The most shattering secret of the last 2,000 years. The first publication of the Holy Blood and the Holy Grail almost 15 years ago, this is a newer edition, sparked off a worldwide storm of controversy, reverberations of which are still resounding throughout the Western world. The book's conclusions and the new material in this revised edition are persuasive and to many will be shocking, even dangerous. Whatever your views, this is truly a book that you will not be able to set aside. And I'm afraid that that's not true for me. I've had to put this down a few times because this book, which I'm sure you've guessed, is about the secret history of the Holy Grail, is written in a sort of pseudo-academic style. So many of the paragraphs end with citations, many of the sentences end with footnotes and superscripts, pointing to a bibliography or to a work cited section at the back of the book. And so I've got two bookmarks in this book at the moment. I've got a bookmark for where I'm reading, and I've got a bookmark for where in the bibliography I've got up to, because I have actually been trying to go through the notes and references section of the appendix of the book, and I've been reviewing the source material. This is a classic conspiracy theory book. It is one of the OG conspiracy theory books about the Holy Grail mysteries. And the authors of the book were making films for the BBC in the 1960s about this. So when people talk about the rise of conspiracy theories and giving pseudo-archaeology airtime in the 2020s, this isn't something new. These theories have been proposed, expanded upon, expounded for decades and decades and decades, some of them for a century, some of them for more than a century. And this particular book is written in a really dense but also adventure style. So it's written in the style of, we did this investigation, here's all the stuff we dug up. So one of the fun things that it says in the book at one point is a certain journalist or a certain historian. And this is used a couple of times, and I always find it funny when conspiracy theory writers say, this was told me by a certain person, a little bird told me that this is the real truth. And I think, well, okay, but you haven't cited them. So this is just made up, isn't it? Like, this is, if you have a source that you're not willing to reveal as a journalist, that's usually a source of information that you then go and follow up as a primary researcher. In journalism, if you say, I can't reveal my source on this, but I have then gone off and investigated the claim that the source has made and found it to be true, and here is the evidence that backs it up, that's how good journalism works. Like, you don't just say, a certain person has told me that the Prime Minister watches dubbed anime instead of subtitled, and then run with that. You have to then follow that up. If you don't follow that up, that is what we call hack journalism. That is just sensationalism. And this book is full of these things where the writers will just say, but how can we explain the fact that this man wasn't punished? And then you read 2 minutes on a Google search will reveal that not only was the person in question punished, they were sacked, defrocked, and never earned a penny legitimately through their priesthood in their lives after this. Like, chapter one is about a priest in France who they claim had this amazing secret source of money, and it turns out he was found guilty of selling indulgences for lots of money. So, mystery solved. But the reason I've got this book, and I'm bringing this book up on this, is today's year of interest is the year 1118, the year 1118. And the year 1118, many of you will already have been saying it out loud, was the foundation year of the Knights Templar, or the Poor Fellow Soldiers of Christ and of the Temple of Solomon, or Pauperes Commilitiones Christi Templique Salomonici Iro Solumitanis. The Knights Templar. Basically, a military order, a military monastic order, Catholic order, very wealthy, very influential, very popular, and one of the subjects of this book, because part of the thrust of this book is that the Knights Templar were involved in guarding, stealing, secreting away, squirreling away, moving around the Holy Grail, the cup used by Jesus at the Last Supper before he was crucified. And the story or the idea of the Holy Grail is a really, really interesting one. It has a great deal of depth. And I believe that Dr. Justin Sledge on his YouTube channel Esoterica has touched on the Holy Grail and the Grail myth. And it really is a very interesting Christian myth. And it emerges hundreds of years after the death of Christ and becomes this fascination for many, many people. This idea that there is an artifact from his life that he touched, that he used, that has been passed on, that has been secreted somewhere, and that there is a conspiracy to keep it hidden, that people have conspired to keep it hidden from people. And that is the key in conspiracy theories. That's why they're called conspiracy theories, is because the general requirement is that some people have conspired against us, the people, the truth seekers of the world, to keep something important secret. So 1118 is the year that we're going to look at, a very important year for conspiracy theorists, because it is the year of the foundation of the Knights Templar. The Knights Templar, I'm sure you have all heard of, the poor fellow soldiers of Christ and of the Temple of Solomon, or Pauperis Commilitionis Christi Templique Salomonici Iro Solimitanis. Bit of a mouthful in the Latin. So, Knights Templar, why not? We'll just call it Knights Templar for short. Now, they are founded in 1118 by a man called Hugues de Payen. Hugues de Payen is the founder, or the co-founder, I should say, and the first Grand Master. He, at this point, is in his 40s. We're not quite sure when he was born, around 1070. But this guy in his 40s, basically, as far as we can tell, is from southern Italy, maybe, and moves to France. He is a knight, so he is a sort of a fairly wealthy man, arguably lower nobility, and we don't know a great deal about him. We have some evidence from things like the diary of the life of Pope Gelasius II, who is only pope between 1118 and 1119, where we have a mention of Brother Ugo de Pagani from the city of Nocera near Salerno. So he's from the Mediterranean, which shouldn't surprise us. We know that the Normans were in that area. We know that, you know, this is a part of the sort of the Frankish conquest of Western Europe. And he, in 1118, we think, has gone to the Holy Land. So we think that he has gone to the Holy Land with another Hugues de Champagne. Hugh, the Count of Champagne, goes to the Holy Land in 1104. He's also there in, I think, 1114. Stays there for a couple of years. And Hugues de Payen stays in Jerusalem. And in 1118, he petitions the new King of Jerusalem, Baldwin II. King Baldwin II has just come to the throne. He's just ascended the throne. And one of the first things he does is approve Hugues de Payen's idea to establish a new military order. So the new military order, the new order, is intended to protect pilgrims on the road. And that is what they're supposed to do. They are supposed to live effectively as monks. They are effectively meant to live a poor life. The clue there is in their name. The poor fellow soldiers of Christ. Pauperes comitiones Christi. Yeah, the poor fellow soldiers of Christ. So these are men who are volunteers. They voluntarily join this order, this monastic order, which involves living a monk-like life. So at least theoretically, celibacy, poverty, yeah, chastity, poverty, piety. So they're supposed to pray. They're supposed to spend a lot of their time in prayer when they're not protecting pilgrims on the road. They are effectively armed monks. And their seal, at least their first symbols, their seal, is two knights riding on one horse, which is meant to show poverty. They're so poor that they have to ride, you know, they have to ride pillion together. They can't even afford enough horses for all of the knights that they have. And at the start, they've only got 9 knights. There's Hugues de Payens and 8 other knights. Now, Hugues de Champagne then joins the Knights Templar. He comes back to Jerusalem and he goes, actually, yes, I'll join you chaps. You seem like a good laugh. And they also have support from a fantastically influential religious figure of the time, Bernard de Clairvaux. So St. Bernard of Clairvaux supports the Knights Templar. He writes in praise of the new knighthood in the late 1120s. He supports them. He throws his weight behind them. At the Council of Troyes, he actually starts writing down their monastic rule, the rule of the order of the temple. And Bernard de Clairvaux is no stranger to this. He is a theologian. He is an abbot. He's a high-ranking monk. He starts the Cistercian order, so he reforms the Benedictine order effectively by starting the Cistercian order, which becomes a huge monastic order. And along with this support comes papal support, comes noble support, comes royal support. If you, as a nobleman, like the Count of Champagne, joins your monastic order, he joins the Knights Templar, you get gifts of land, you get gifts of money, all of which you then plough into equipping yourselves, buying horses, buying fodder, buying food, because you have, because they are granted a wing of the palace on the Temple Mount. These knights are granted a very prestigious part of the holy city of Jerusalem. They are given part of the temple. And that's very, very important and very, very influential. This is where some of the conspiracy theorists creep in. They say, how did these people get this? How did these poor 8 or 9 knights get all of this privilege? And the answer, of course, is because they did what they did at the right time. 1118, Baldwin II comes to the throne. One of his first acts is to approve a new monastic order. It's going to protect the pilgrims who come in their thousands to Jerusalem. It's a huge part of his economy, is the pilgrimage economy. So he has these people who are ready and willing to defend those pilgrims on the road. And remember, the order starts with 9 knights. That's not all of the people. There weren't just 9 people rattling around. They had servitors, they had lay brethren, they had non-knights, they had various people. And eventually, in the next couple of decades, they become very, very wealthy. They get huge tracts of land. They are given massive grants of money. In 1135, Pope Innocent II gives the first papal donation to them. In 1135, he gives them money for the first time. And in 1139, his papal bull, Omnidatum Optimum, exempts the Templars from obeying local laws. They can pass freely through borders. Yeah, they don't pay taxes. They are exempt from any authority except that of the Pope. They answer to nobody but the Pope. Now, obviously, in reality, if they have a temple, or if they start up a mission or a house in a European country, they have to respect the requests of the ruler of that country, or they'll find themselves kicked out or accused of heresy, PDQ. So they are not above the law, but in terms of the Pope, they basically can do no wrong. And they are seen as doing no wrong in part because Bernard de Clairvaux writes glowingly of them. He writes about them being noble. He calls them holy. He says they are holy. He says that if you go to the Holy Land and you join the order and you fight, you are doing a great and wonderful and holy and Christian thing. If you die fighting with the order, he says that's even better because you're just going to go straight to heaven, no questions asked. He basically is so enamored with the idea of these noble French knights giving up being these violent, thuggish, wealthy, basically upper-class thugs, yeah? They're giving all of that up to go and live a life of chastity and poverty in the Holy Land to defend the holy city and the pilgrims going to it. That is music to his ears. And I will quote from it in praise of the new knighthood, De Laude Novae Militiae, or Militiae, I beg your pardon, in 1135, he says, he describes a Templar as truly fearless, secure on all sides, for his soul is defended by the armour of the faith, as his body is defended by his armour of steel. He is therefore doubly armed and need fear neither demons nor men. Wow. So, pretty strong stuff. Now, I mentioned that it wasn't just knights, and eventually it became not just knights. About 90% of the body of the Knights Templar weren't fighting men. They weren't combatants. Most of them acted in, well, various ways. They acted as financiers, they acted as administrators. They had to have people who were cleaning armour, repairing armour, making clothing, repairing weapons and clothes, feeding the horses, feeding the men, cooking the food, attending to the buildings, all of this sort of stuff. And although individual members were sworn to poverty, they had huge, huge amounts of money. You might place all of your money in the trust of the order if you went on crusade, for example. And they accumulated huge amounts of wealth. They began to give letters of credit to pilgrims. So they would basically, pilgrims would put their valuables in a preceptory, a local Templar headquarters, before they went off on crusade. You would get a document, and it would say, this is how much it is worth, and on arrival in the Holy Land, you could claim some money equal to the value of the funds. So, banking. Basically a checkbook, right? You deposit your wealth with the Templars in France, and then when you go to the Holy Land, you present your letter to the Templars in Jerusalem and say, hello, I would like half a pound's worth of silver, please. As you can see, I have this signed preceptory, from this signed letter from the preceptory in Troyes, and now that I'm here in Jerusalem, I would like to take 50 pounds of silver out of my account, which sounds like a lot because I am ill and I don't know what money was worth back then, but basically a checkbook. And this is something that was really innovative. And obviously, there were payments of interest involved in some of their dealings, and there was, you know, some money lending going on. But they also worked in import and export. They had ships, they had a fleet of ships. At one point they owned Cyprus, the whole island. And they were effectively a multinational business interest, a corporation, if you like. And they had incredible rights. They were allowed to negotiate with Muslim rulers. Their castles and preceptories in the Holy Land basically became independent states, or at least lordships. Their authority was massive. When Baldwin IV dies in 1185, his estates, the royal estates, were put in trust with the Templars and the Knights Hospitaller. Their grandmasters had access to the crown jewels, which is incredible. It's just unbelievable. They go all over the place. They go to Eastern Europe. They go to Spain. They eventually there is a split, and they go up to the northeastern Europe. And we have the Teutonic campaign. I think it's pronounced Teuton in German, but I could be wrong. But they are also very effective warriors. So the Knights Templar are these monastic nobles who have given up their life of luxury and fighting in France. They go over to Jerusalem, they go over to the Holy Land, and they have this new individual life of poverty within this quickly very wealthy organization. And if you think, how can individuals working for a wealthy company be poor? I invite you to look at how Amazon workers are paid compared to how their chief executive officer is paid. I invite you to look at how bar staff are paid compared to how wealthy the owner of a multi-chain pub franchise might be paid. Still happens today. There's no conspiracy required. But they are also effective fighters, as I was saying, because they're knights. These are medieval noblemen who are trained in combat. They are trained in the use of the spear and the sword and in horse riding. And so even 9 knights, it doesn't sound like very much, does it? But 9 knights will, fully armoured, equipped and on horseback, beat the granny out of dozens of poorly armed peasant infantrymen. They simply will plough through them. They are better equipped. They have excellent morale. They believe that they are fighting a holy cause in the name of God. They consider themselves indestructible because God is on their side. They are encased, like Bernard says, their soul is protected by God and their body is encased in steel. And 9 knights will make a difference. 500 knights, which is what they were fielding towards the end of the 12th century, will win a battle. 500 Knights Templar, fully armed, fully equipped, will win a battle for you, if you can afford them. So, where does it all go wrong? Well, the Templars are fighting a little bit within themselves. They're at odds a little bit with some of the other orders, like the Knights Hospitaller. And there are these feuds going on. The holy city, Jerusalem, is lost. Yes. In no small part due to leaders like Saladin, the famous Ayyubid dynasty founder. He's a Kurd. He's born in Mesopotamia, in modern-day Iraq. The town is now named after him. The town that he was born in is now called Saladin in Iraq, modern-day Iraq. And Jerusalem is captured by Saladin in 1187. The Templars try to get it back and fail. In 1229, the Holy Roman Emperor, Frederick II, takes it back without the help of Templars, which is important. He did it without the help of the Knights Templar, who by 1229, when it happens, are a major European political force, right? It's taken back again, and it doesn't return to Western control, to European control, until 1917, when the British Empire captures it from the Ottoman Empire. So from 1244, Jerusalem is taken from Western Europe. Now that means that the Templars have to move. So they go to Acre, which is spelled Acre, A-C-R-E, in English and I believe in French. But I think it's called Akka in Arabic, A-K-K-A, I think it's transliterated as. Anyway, regardless, they go to Acre, which they lose after a century in 1291. Boom, gone. They start losing all of their strongholds in the Holy Land. They lose Tartush, they lose Aklit. They have to move to Cyprus, to Limassol. Remember, they own the island of Cyprus. And they try to keep a few garrisons off the coast of the Holy Land, but it doesn't really work. They try to work with the Mongols at one point. They try to reinvade the Holy Land with the Mongols, but it doesn't work. They lose the Holy Land. The Holy Land is gone by the 14th century. So 1303, I think, is it, it's gone. They've lost the Holy Land. People stop supporting them. Why would we support you? Your job was to protect pilgrims, was to defend the Holy Land. You failed. So why would we now support you? But they're part of people's lives now. There are hundreds and hundreds of preceptories, Templar houses. They are a daily presence in many major towns. They're in London. They're in Edinburgh. They're all over the place. They're in Paris. You can't move without there being Templar stuff around. They've got loads of business interests. They still have farms. They have vineyards. They've got thousands of acres of land all over the place. They're still not subject to local laws. They're still this independent state inside another country. They've got a standing army that can just pass between countries. They can just move between borders. They are this company, basically. They're an international corporation with its own army that can move around borders and not pay taxes. Sound familiar? And eventually, royals and nobles start getting a little bit ticked off with them. The Templars start saying, well, maybe we want to start our own state, like the Hospitallers did in Rhodes. Eventually, they start being accused of corruption. They start being accused of heresy because they have initiation rituals that are supposedly heretical. And soon, the Pope starts to get annoyed and says, in 1305, Pope Clement V says, right, I think we need to combine the Templars and the Hospitallers. We need you to merge. Neither of the Grandmasters wants this. Jacques de Molay, Grandmaster of the Templars, Fulk de Villaret, Grandmaster of the Hospitallers, says, nah, not keen. And in 1306 and 1307, the Pope Clement V and Jacques de Molay meet, and they start talking about how false charges have been laid against Knights Templar. And Pope Clement writes to King Philip IV of France and says, hey, can you help with this investigation? We're investigating some naughty goings-on by the Knights Templar. And Philip was in debt to the Templars, so he decides to seize upon this. He says, yes, of course I'll help you investigate the Knights Templar. I think they probably are heretical. I think you need to take action against them. I think you need to, in fact, get rid of the Knights Templar. He is in massive, massive debt to the Knights Templar. He has been fighting a war against England that has been costing him his fortune. And on Friday the 13th of October, right, helps influence the suspicion, superstition of Friday the 13th, but we actually have other sources of the Friday the 13th superstition. But on Friday the 13th of October 1307, Jacques de Molay and dozens of other Templars are arrested. They're simultaneously arrested by King Philip IV of France. And he actually starts with the arrest warrant goes extremely hard. It starts with the words, the arrest warrant that Philip IV gives to the Templars, by the way, goes extremely hard. The first sentence is, Dieu n'est pas content. Nous avons des ennemis de la foi dans le royaume. God is not pleased. We have enemies of the faith in the kingdom. Extremely hard, extremely powerful start to an arrest warrant as you batter down the door of a Templar castle. But Templars are basically interrogated, tortured under interrogation. They're accused of all sorts of things that were crimes at the time. Spitting on the cross is one of the major ones. Worshipping idols and homosexual activity, which there is debate about how illegal it was at the time. It would certainly have been extremely frowned upon for a monastic order of noblemen to be encouraging homosexual activity. It's worth remembering that all of these accusations are recycled. These are the accusations that are made against witches, against Jewish people, against people accused of all the other kinds of heresy. Albigensians and Cathars are accused of exactly the same stuff. It's all political. There is no real evidence that any of this was going on. The only real evidence we have of all of this is from the minutes of these interrogations, right? These French royal scribes, these Catholic church-affiliated investigators and inquisitors write all of this stuff down. And I've read them in the Latin, and it's pretty clear stuff. If you go on the Wikipedia page for the Knights Templar, you can read some of it. You can read, one of them is, "Moi, Raymond de la Fère, 21 ans, reconnais que j'ai craché trois fois sous le croix, mais de bouche et pas de cœur. I, Raymond de la Fère, 21 years old, admit that I have spat three times on the cross, but only from my mouth and not from my heart." And that is a confession under torture, basically, under coercion. So, Pope Clement issues a papal bull, Pastoralis Praeeminentiae, on November the 22nd, which tells every Christian monarch in Europe to arrest all of the Templars in their country and take all of their assets. Their assets are all seized. The Pope calls for hearings to determine their guilt or innocence, the Templars' guilt or innocence, and many Templars, once they were out of the Inquisition, recanted. Lots of them said, "Right, now that I'm free, this is all nonsense. None of this is true. It's all a lie. I was forced to do this." And it's actually kind of amazing that some of them managed to do that and live. Several of them then go on to defend the order. Various nobles, French nobles mostly, have some legal experience. They defend the order. They defend themselves at the trials. But effectively, it doesn't work. Philip IV is at this point threatening the Pope with military action. So the order is disbanded. The scandal is used, the confessions are used as the reason, and in 1312, he says, the order's gone, it's dissolved. Most of their assets then go to the Knights Hospitaller, which must have been really galling for Jacques de Molay, who didn't really get on with folk, I don't think, but he actually did. He was one of the people who retracted, he recanted his confession, but it didn't do them any good. And Jacques de Molay, along with another, Geoffroy de Charnay, are burned alive at the stake in Paris. 18th of March, 1314, Jacques de Molay is burnt to death. And apparently Jacques de Molay said, "Tie me to the stake so that I'm facing Notre Dame, and tie my hands together so that I can die in prayer." That's not a quote, that's what he... we're told, according to legend, that he did that. He said, "Tie me up, but tie me facing Notre Dame and tie my hands up in prayer so that I can die praying like a Christian," which is also extremely hard. There's also a legend that he predicted that Pope Clement and King Philip IV would soon die. And Clement died the next month, Philip died within the same year during a hunting trip. So make of that what you will. Lots of legends, lots of mythos, lots of remembering that in the medieval period you could just make stuff up in documents, much like Roman lawyers could simply make things up. Cicero was renowned for just making things up about people that he was litigating, or people who he was against in court. He would just make stuff up. And you could just do that in the medieval period. You could basically just make things up. You could say, "Yeah, he confessed. He confessed to doing all of this. Yeah, but he did it under torture. Yeah, but he confessed." Like, it's not great. Now, most of that, I know, was after 1118. But 1118 is the year that starts all of that. And it's less than 200 years. It's like the Viking Age. What's the Viking Age in practice? Like 250 years? Not a hugely long period. But it's interesting, isn't it, that so many things, just like we're going to learn about in the next episode, and like we talked about with Chelsea Rutke, so many things are happening that are echoed in the modern age. We have a huge multinational corporation that doesn't pay its taxes, that appears to be able to move freely between countries. We have a large organization whose members are ostensibly poor, but which has a vast amount of cash, huge holdings of land. Nobody seems to be able to get these people to contribute to the taxes in the places where they live. And a quote attributed to Mark Twain, history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. Right? Maybe we need to learn how to temper organizations like this before they get out of control, before they tick off the wrong monarch or the wrong leader. Maybe we need to make sure that if there are organizations like the Templars, that they are working for the good, that they are not above the law, that they are not above repercussions for wrongdoing, but that it's done in a way that doesn't involve inquisitorial torture, extrajudicial arrest, burning at the stake, and the corruption of the papacy by threats of military action from the King of France. Just thinking aloud here. You know, people say, why should we learn history? Why is history important? This is why it's important, because if you don't remember it, it keeps happening again and again. So, what can we learn from this? I don't know, that honey, lemon and ginger is a cure-all, and that you should buy local, you should buy sustainable, and that if you want to support my channel financially, you can go to the Patreon page, which I will link to, or you can go to the Ko-fi page, or if you want to just support by sharing, then please do share, like, write a little review on Spotify or on Apple Music if you can do, or on the YouTube channel, leave a comment, and subscribe to the channel. I really hope you enjoyed this. I love the Knights Templar as a subject. I think they are a fascinating subject. The fact that they were sponsored by a leading mystic of the time, Bernard de Clairvaux, that they had unswerving papal support for a century and a half, that they had royals giving them money, they had nobles giving them money, people were volunteering to join them and give up their lives in the cause, I think is all fascinating. And it's a fascinating way to look at the medieval mindset as well. So far removed from many of us now, this mindset of going over and joining this order and doing this thing for religious reasons. Fascinating. But diolch yn fawr iawn am wrando. Thank you very much for listening. I hope that you've enjoyed this, and I hope that you will join me for the next episode, where we're going to be bringing things a little bit more recent. I think we're going about 500 years more recent, I predict. And we've got another fantastic guest. So please do join me next time for more Steeped in History. Be well, don't get a horrible cold, and until the next time, tan o tro nesa, hwyl fawr am y tro. Bye-bye for now. Steeped in History is presented by Jimmy Johnson, researched by Jimmy Johnson, produced and edited by Jimmy Johnson, and features music by Ina Ban. It is hosted on the Audio Boom Podcast Network, and I have done far too much talking today.